Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to Pretty Lies and Alibis. Let's seek the truth and travel the long road to justice together. What you know, alibiers? Welcome to another episode of Pretty Lies and Alibis. I'm Gigi. Hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving. Mine was wonderful. I went back three times for food, and I left there feeling like I was about 7 months pregnant, but it wasn't a baby. It was just all that ham and turkey and Grammy's banana pudding and sweets and everything else in between. But it was really nice to have my family together and just took a moment to be really grateful that everybody for that moment in that room is happy and healthy. And so it's things like that that really matter, especially the last few weeks, especially. It seems like we've been covering these murders that involve multiple people, and it's just a scary world these days. So I just took a moment to be really grateful last night that while we're definitely feeling the loss this year with a couple of family members that passed away, there's a different angle, I think, when there's murders involved and a little less resolution. So I thought about a lot of the cases we've been covering lately and some of the old ones too, family members that are dealing with such a hard loss. We have a lot to update today, a couple of new cases added on to talk about. Before we get started, we're going to jump over to Broadway Musical Theater. One of my favorites. I love Broadway. I love taking my kids to Broadway shows. It's Hamilton has become a staple in our house. And Rent, by the way, is probably my all-time favorite Broadway show. But the top five highest grossing musicals since 1982. Number five, The Book of Mormon. Number four, Chicago. Number three, Phantom of the Opera. Number two, Wicked. And number one, The Lion King. I'm sure over time Hamilton will take over this list in one of those spots. I was surprised Rent wasn't on there. It was such a huge hit. Great story that was taught in the 90s that was a little bit ahead of its time. And the creator of that show, Jonathan Larson, was a genius. Very tragic what happened to him. He died the night of the final dress rehearsal before it went into off-Broadway. And man, I tell you what a legacy he left behind in that. All right, let's jump into Shanquilla Robinson. So haven't heard anything about the suspect that they have an arrest warrant for being picked up. It could be that is in the process of happening. Don't know if somebody's hiding or what, but they haven't said anything so far about detaining that suspect who they have not named. But I'm keeping an eye out. As soon as I hear anything, I will let you know. Her father, Bernard Robinson, spoke to News Nation Now saying he has struggled every day and he's not doing well at all. He said, "It just turned my life upside down, but I asked God to show me what really happened over there in Mexico." He also said he wants to see more of the people that she went on that trip with to be questioned. And he said when viewing her body at the funeral home, he noticed she had a knot on her head, a swollen eye, and her lip was cut. He said, "My daughter, she's not a fighter. I didn't raise her to be that kind of way. I raised her to love and respect people." He said, "Every day is a struggle for me because she's not here. I can't be a granddaddy, walk her down the aisle, can't hear her voice." So hoping that not only is there an arrest in the case soon, but also that, like he said, other people are questioned. People did not stop that beating that was caught on camera. How somebody can sit there and record a beating and not stop it, I do not know. And ask, why aren't you fighting back? My question is, why weren't you stopping it, dude? Like, why weren't you jumping in and helping that poor girl? But hey, Maybe the authorities will ask that question. George Wagner, court resumes on Monday for closing arguments. So attorneys were able to get most of those jury instructions nailed down. So they've had most of the week off, but they'll meet again Monday morning before the jury comes in to finalize a few things. They are set to return to the courthouse at their normal time. So remember, death is off the table for George. So what is he charged with? Aggravated murder, conspiracy, engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity, tampering with evidence, unlawful possession of a dangerous ordinance, and aggravated burglary. So me and Big E, we've been talking back and forth this evening through text. And I think maybe a week, almost a week of no court, we're a little bored and our minds are going, but you know, we're going to maybe do a live Monday night and bring Jamie on as well, because she has been in the courthouse taking notes for us and we want to get her input. But we were just wondering, why set up this elaborate hoax drug deal? If you and Chris are best friends and on good terms, why put a platform underneath, you know, this fake hay for them to lay in? If you're such besties, why do you need an excuse to go over to his house? Just little things like that we've been going back and forth on. We have a lot of questions, and I think after closings, we're just going to hop on and do a live, talk about our thoughts about the closings and just throw around things we still don't understand. I'm not sure that we ever will. I'm not sure we will ever know what truly happened that night. Another thing that Big E was like, yeah, and why would they go back to Kenneth twice? You're just risking an accident. You're risking being pulled over in the middle of this murder spree. Lots of things. So also there's a picture of Shanquilla. So hope and justice for her comes very, very soon. And so now Carrie Allen is a 43-year-old who has been missing since November 19th from Omaha, Nebraska. She was last seen at 11 p.m. that night on 168th Street and Blondo. She's divorced and has a teenage son who was staying with his father the weekend she went missing. Neighbors say that she was around that day, and she mentioned she had plans with someone that night. A search warrant was executed at a home of a man last Tuesday after another person who lived in that home called 911 and said someone living at that address may have, quote, killed his girlfriend. Police haven't confirmed if there is a connection between the two. That home is about 150 miles from where Carrie lives, and investigators were seeing Carrie and some evidence out of that home. The next day, neighbors say while investigators were searching her residence, a car was found in the garage and removed and taken into custody. Police have not confirmed that that car was taken, but neighbors saw it. So this morning, investigators were seen at a landfill, which is about 15 minutes from her home, and confirmed the search was in relation to her disappearance. Investigators say based on the leads they're currently pursuing, they do not believe there is a threat to the community. A little bit about Carrie. She runs a program at an organization that provides services for people with disabilities. She's described as a doting mother and someone who never knew a stranger. Those who know her say she would have never left her son or left without saying where she was going. She's 5'8", weighs 130 pounds with hazel eyes and blonde hair. She wears both curly and straight. Somebody that knows her posted this on Facebook. I took their name off just for privacy, but anyone with information is asked to call 402-444-6000. So I will keep you updated on that one. So we are still talking about the University of Idaho murders. Kaylee's family has spoken out to the media in the last few days. And so but first, the university will allow students to finish up the year with remote learning. Some students, obviously and understandably, don't want to return to campus since no suspect has been detained. Others on the opposite side feel like they want the structure of in-person learning, so that option's available as well. A vigil will be held on campus November 30th for Kaylee, Ethan, Zana, and Maddie. And they will also have a virtual option for those who do not choose to attend. Kaylee's father, brother, and sister spoke to CNN, and her father said this isn't real yet, and he's in denial. So he's trying to switch modes to seeking justice. Her brother said crying himself to sleep isn't going to help, and he wants to do whatever he can to spread her message. Her sister Olivia was the one who actually found the food truck video herself. I did not know this. I know she's been working really hard behind the scenes trying to figure out things on her own. And that's understandable with the lack of information that clearly the families have gotten from law enforcement. She said this is personal for them and they're treating it that way. She hopes police have a lot of information that they're not sharing. And I do think that's the case. You have 22 FBI agents. You have multiple agencies collectively working on this. It's understandable that they don't put out everything they have. For instance, the deny or them not denying that a specific student was targeted, that one of them was targeted, one of the four. To me, that speaks volumes. Also, the fact that they're still not releasing that 911 call. I went over this on the previous video, but something had to be said on that 911 call that is sensitive to the investigation. So her sister, Kaylee's sister, has a problem with the timeline. She says her sister got home at 1:56 a.m. and not 1:45. Kaylee's mother believes the suspect is somebody Kaylee knows very well. Her dad, Steve, said that's speculation, and he knows Kaylee was very popular and said it's possible with how they had people over for parties frequently that could have led to somebody getting an idea. And he thinks maybe the killer knows the layout of the house. But here's the thing. If you think about it, and we talk about the suspect pool being huge, if they had frequent parties, can you imagine the amount of DNA in that house that belongs to a whole lot of people other than the killer? You're talking about strands of hair that people have lost, touched DNA on doorknobs, toilet seats, sinks, everything. On one hand, you can see how this is an investigation nightmare from that standpoint, in that you have to eliminate tons of people before you really can narrow it down. I don't envy law enforcement, but I do understand the family's frustration with the lack of what seems like movement in the case. As far as a stalker, her sister said that that information would be new to them and that Kaylee FaceTimed her often for hours. And she said if she had a stalker, Kaylee would have told her about it. So maybe that's not the case. I'm sure if she had one or if she thought she had one, she might have relayed that to family. But on the same token, she may not want to worry family either. It's really hard to know. The police are not sharing anything with them, really, that they're not sharing with the public. And we know that from cases past, where I know family members from other murder cases who sometimes I will inform them of new news that comes out in the case. And it's really not what you think, that the family gets a heads up every time there's something new that's discovered, which I think really they should contact the families first, because I'm sure hearing certain things online or reading things on Twitter or Facebook or seeing a news alert is not fun when it's your loved one. Her dad said he's in contact with local authorities and he understands that other agencies such as the FBI are involved now, so he may not be getting all the new updates. And when speaking of the possibility that one of the students was targeted, he said, I've been told it's one, but then again, there's the bigness, like it's purposely big. Kaylee's mother, Christy, talked to KHQ News, saying that Kaylee had just been home and was debating all day if she should go back to Moscow, but as we know, she did, so she could show off her new car, which apparently she was very proud of. Her hometown was about 100 miles away from Moscow, and her mom said she knows Kaylee had a good Friday because the two spoke for the last time around 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, just about 13 hours before the murders. She tried texting Kaylee that Sunday morning to see how her evening went, and obviously that went unanswered. We know the murders, according to police, were sometime between 3 and 4 a.m., and I'm curious how they've come up with that very specific timeline. It's easy to say 3 because we know the texts were sent to the ex-boyfriend Jack's phone, by the way, who, as a reminder, has been cleared. But why 3 and 4? What gives them that 4 o'clock cutoff is what I'm curious to know as well. So again, that leads me to think they've got things they know that they're not sharing about a timeline. She said the time that she sent that text that morning to Kaylee would have been about the time that police were responding to the house after that 911 call was made at 11:58 a.m. Ultimately, her family was visited by police that Sunday afternoon to inform them of the murders. She said it makes them sick to think that with how big these services and candlelight vigils are for these kids, that it's possible the murderer could be sitting among them. And I'm sure that is a very disturbing thought. She feels in her gut they knew their killer with how small that town is. And she believes it was premeditated, saying this person somehow snuck into the house whether it was a door or a window, not invited, and came in with a weapon with intention to kill, not just one, but four, one right after another, 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 and another. And that's very true. I really do believe that this had to have been premeditated. If it was a last minute thing, I really do think it, we would have our suspect by now. Whoever did this, I do think, plotted this out. She pled to the killer. Kaylee's mom pled to the killer last Sunday saying, turn yourself in, stop all this. Let us mourn our children. We can't with this person out there. Just end it. The guilt has to be overwhelming. Stop hiding. Investigators worked through the holiday yesterday. The home is still being guarded 24/7 by deputies, and there's some pink tape that seals the front door, and it's marked off with the time stamped each investigator goes in. The cars of the victims are still parked out front. So I have some things that I think about. Did they find any blood evidence outside of the house from any of the exit points? Is there a chance the killer cleaned up after the murders? And what, yeah, still, it's going to be that narrow time frame. Why are they so certain that between 3 and 4, these happen? And now it's time for a word from our paid sponsor of the week, The Vanished by Wondery. It's hard to imagine losing a loved one, a wife, a husband, a child. For many, including me, it's our biggest fear. From Wondery, The Vanished is a podcast that tells the stories of often overlooked and unsolved missing person cases. Every week, host Marissa Jones dives into a new case, sharing the details of their mysterious disappearance from interviews with family, friends, law enforcement, and even suspects in an effort to reveal the truth. The Vanished has even aided in getting long overdue arrests through their in-depth interviews. Marissa reminds the listeners of the human behind the headline and aims to help family members find their vanished loved one, or at least a sense of peace. I love this podcast because missing person cases oftentimes fall out of the headlines, leaving only family and friends to seek the truth. Follow The Vanished on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, or listen early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So the public information officer for Moscow PD told Court TV's Shanley Painter, who's there, there's no specific updates at this time. And Shanley's really good. She asks a lot of really pointed questions. And essentially the answers were pretty much the same, a flat out, we don't know, or it's part of the investigation. I really just get the feeling from his answers that they still have no clue who did this, which is scary. He did say they don't know if the person knew the four or not. They're just still not sure about that. The prosecutor, Bill Thompson, was seen at the police department yesterday. Communications director for the Idaho State Police said he's there daily. His presence does not indicate a break in the case. And so just a reminder, the two surviving roommates, the man seen in the hoodie on the food truck, as well as Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, Jack, have been ruled out as suspects. So I like to remind people of that. On a side note, Joseph Scott Morgan, who hopped on our live last week to talk about George Wagner, he's very well versed on that, forensic guy, super smart. He has a new episode out about the Idaho murders on his podcast, Body Bags. It's super good, very insightful. I'm going to link that in the description today so you guys can go check it out. I love his podcast. Definitely one of my favorites, if not my favorite. Just overall. The tip line for the University of Idaho murders is 208-883-7180 or email tipline at ci.moscow.id.us. All right, Alec Murdaugh, Russell Lafitte, who is the first of probably many people tangled up with Alec Murdaugh to face trial, was found guilty on all charges in federal court earlier this week. Those charges were conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bank fraud, bank fraud, wire fraud, misapplication of bank funds. Those were three separate counts. His family was seen crying after the verdict was read. He faces 180 years in prison at sentencing and $1 million fine. By the way, no parole in the federal system at all. That was abolished. He is still out on bond until his sentencing hearing, which has not been scheduled yet. If it's been scheduled, I don't know the date. During deliberations, it got a little tense. The judge was sent four notes by the jury. Two were from the same juror who said they needed to take medication and they felt pressure to change their vote. That juror was dismissed and replaced. A third note came in that said, "Dear Judge, we are writing to you as a group saying they felt one juror had expressed they had been bullied while serving on another jury at some point in the past was getting in their way of deliberating the case. The juror in question was described as being hostile to hearing any debate from certain jurors and won't consider evidence in the trial at all." The fourth note was asking the judge to call an alternate juror, saying that they were experiencing anxiety and were unable to make a clear decision. The judge spoke to that juror and said it was best if they were excused. The judge said, "Never seen anything like this." And anyways, it did result, I believe, around 12 hours, if not a little more, a little less, of deliberation before finding him guilty on all charges. So switching over to Alec Murdaugh, defense attorneys for him filed a 96-page motion on Wednesday saying the state is relying on bad faith evidence or gross negligence from his T-shirt that allegedly had all that blood spatter on it, which seems to be kind of a key piece of evidence linking him to the crime scene. They claim they were not aware of this until November 4th of this year, until requesting an independent lab be allowed to take microscopic photographs of the shirt. Now, they say the testing methods that the state law enforcement division used turned the shirt black, and there's no chance to have the photos taken at this point. In the filing, they say that SLED, which is the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, conducted DNA testing on the stains in June of last year and found DNA from Maggie, but not Paul. Remember that. They also say that South Carolina officials hired Tom Bevel, a retired Oklahoma City detective, to assist in the analysis of the shirt, and claims that he initially determined that the shirt had no stains consistent with back spatter from a shotgun blast, and concluded the shirt had been destroyed by the blood tests. So Alec's attorney said of the shirt, it turned out completely blue. All stains were blue, fuzzy, and bled out. Their features lost forever. It's a well-known documented issue with LCV tests. There are methods to prevent LCV tests from staining the entire substance over time, but SLED elected to conduct its test in a manner that would prevent anyone else from conducting subsequent tests. Now, the final report from Bevel says that blood stain pattern experts agreed the best explanation for the stains on the shirt are high velocity blood spatter, most likely resulting from shooting Paul. Remember, he said Maggie initially. So his attorneys say the different conclusions from the initial and the final report are, despite having no additional evidence since the shirt was destroyed before he released his final report, they're blaming now SLED's dishonest concealment of the destruction when obtaining a false report, saying that his shirt had over 100 high-velocity impact spatter blood stains consistent with a gunshot, Lord, my eyes are bloodshots, what they are. When SLED knows the shirt does not have any human blood at all, based on Mr. Bevel's examination of the shirt on March 10th, 2022, the fact that it was already destroyed, they say it makes the report consistent with what the state wanted it to be. So interesting. This is going to be one of those to watch. I mean, there's going to be a problem, I think, if the defense was not allowed to conduct their own testing or whatever they want on it. That's a big key piece of evidence. I know now they have other evidence linking him to the murders, but this trial is set to start in January, and I'm going to be covering that like I'm covering George Wagner every day, breaking down 8 hours of testimony into an hour. But it's going to be an interesting trial for sure, so I'm going to keep an eye on that one too. Now, let's just file this one under the 50 Shades of Grey girlfriend, and I don't know how to pronounce her first name. There were no videos on this. It was not a huge viral story. I just happened to come across it today, but I think it's Sanadia or Sanada Marie Soto. She's charged with arson and burglary after breaking into the home of her boyfriend, stealing several items and setting fire to the couch, which spread to other parts of the house, causing $50,000 in damage. Why? Well, she FaceTimed her boyfriend and a female answered the FaceTime, but she probably should have clarified who the female was because it ended up being a relative of the boyfriend and not some other woman that's moving in on her man. So after she set the fire, she FaceTimed her boyfriend, showing him the fire and said, "I hope your house is okay," before hanging up. A witness also saw her loading things from the home into her car. Whoa, boy, I tell you what, her bond is set at $165,000 and she has a hearing set for December 6th. I bet she's feeling really stupid right about now. So the latest unfortunate murders that we are covering, the Walmart employee and gunman, 31-year-old Andre Bean, killed 6 and wounded 3 in a November 22nd shooting in a break room at a Walmart in Virginia. He's been employed there since 2010. He legally purchased a 9mm handgun the morning of the shootings, and investigators found the box and the receipt inside his home while executing a search warrant after the murders. He had no criminal history, and he was found at the scene with a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. He is deceased. They located several magazines on him. So when he entered the store, he was wearing civilian clothes, and the shootings began at 10:12 p.m. Employee Kevin Harper had just left the break room and said Andre came in and just started shooting. An eyewitness to the shootings, whose life was spared, who had only been working there for 5 days, by the way, crouched under a table. The gunman walked over to her and said, "Go home, Jesse." She ran out before Andre turned the gun on himself. She told the Associated Press the way he was acting, he was going hunting. The way he was looking at people's faces and the way he did what he was picking people out. What I do know is that he made sure who he wanted dead was dead. She said he went back in and shot several bodies that were already clearly deceased. She said the sound of the victim's drops of blood hitting the floor just replays in her mind. That's just something, too. You think about the victims and stuff, but then you think about somebody like her who's going to be affected till the day she takes her last breath. Seeing that and hearing that, and she said the smell, you know, so many things I can't imagine. She's a 15-month-old daughter, by the way, 15-month-old daughter. Two victims and the shooter were located inside that break room. One victim was found near the front of the store, and then three more died at the hospital. Authorities released a note today that they found on his phone where he rambles on about God and the Holy Spirit and how he felt his associates were giving him twisted evil grins, mocking him, and then he said celebrated his downfall the last day. The note says, "I wish I could have saved everyone from myself. My God, forgive me for what I'm going to do." Now, what's interesting is a reporter who was outside of his house found a note in his trash can with a schedule for Walmart with some of the victims' names circled and gave that to the FBI. Let's talk about the victims, y'all. This is always the worst part. 16-year-old Fernando Chavez Barron, the youngest victim, 16 years old, worked third shift to help his family while attending high school during the day. 38-year-old Brian Pendleton, he was a custodian who wasn't set to go on duty until 10:30, but his mom said he was very punctual, and he was in the break room just a little after 10 waiting on a shift to begin, according to his mother, whose name is Michelle Johnson. She said he always came early to be sure he clocked in on time and also said that he loved his coworkers. His mom said he didn't have any problems at work except for his supervisor, who is the gunman. She said the gunman just didn't like her son, and her son told her that Andre gave him a hard time. She said her son had a congenital brain disorder, and he would call her before he went to work, and she always told him to call her when he got off work. A friend of the family called her that night to tell her there had been a shooting at his Walmart. She said he was a happy-go-lucky person who loved his family, his friends, and loved to tell jokes. A former coworker said that he thought of Brian as an older brother and said if you had any problems, you could go to Brian. He would go to bat for you and help you with anything. 52-year-old Kelly Pyle, she had planned to be married next year, and her future mother-in-law, Gwendolyn Spencer, said she would be remembered as an awesome and kind individual. She had just moved back to Virginia in May after reconnecting with her high school sweetheart and had recently just gotten this job at Walmart. A cousin of hers spoke to the Washington Post and said, "We will miss her sarcastic sense of humor," and said, "We grew up in a crazy family and we understood each other. I don't remember life without her." She has adult children who lived in Kentucky. 43-year-old Lorenzo Gamble, a custodian whose parents said he loved spending time with his two sons. His mother, Linda, said he was the quiet one of the family and kept to himself a lot, but did his job. He enjoyed going to his son's football games and loved the Washington Commanders. His mother said that she had given Lorenzo the task of making banana pudding cake and banana pudding for the Thanksgiving dinner. When she went to Lorenzo's home after the murders, the ingredients were sitting on his counter. 70-year-old Randy Blevins, longtime employee who set prices and arranged merchandise. A former coworker who worked with Mr. Randy, who she affectionately called Mr. Randy, said the third shift crew really was like a family. Mr. Randy loved Admirals, hockey team, photography, and coin collecting. His daughter, Cassandra, told the New York Times that he never missed a single day of work. He loved his family and supported everyone. So 22-year-old Tanika Johnson, a former tutor of hers, said she had dreams of going to college and had a very supportive family. She said education was in the forefront. Her family did whatever they had to do to make sure she got assistance. She was cheerful, helped younger students, and gelled with everyone she encountered at the tutoring services she attended. She said Tanika had a sense of style, loved music and dancing. She said she was that kid. When she came to tutoring, she was well put together. She was a light in a dim room. Her cousin told the New York Times that Tanika was independent and wanted to make her own money. So again, just tragedy all around. You hear about these victims and you know, you hear their stories and how people saw them. And it's just more than a picture that, you know, unfortunately, these pictures are sometimes multiple times a week of all these shootings. And so anyways, just a heavy week, heavy few weeks. It's always heavy doing true crime. But the last few weeks have just, to me, been full of multiple tragedies that, none of them needed to happen. But hopefully we will get somewhere with the suspect in Shanquilla's case, as well as with the University of Idaho murders. Carrie Allen, keep you updated on those. That's all I got for you tonight. Be back Monday, maybe tomorrow. Not sure if anything big happens in any of these cases. I'm home, so I'll just hop on and do a little quick one. But anyways, wanted to get these out to you guys. Hope you had a great day. I'm going to spend the rest of my evening taking advantage of some Black Friday deals, trying to get as much done as I can today while the savings are out there and to be had. All right, we'll see you, if not tomorrow, definitely on Monday. I'm going to break down those closing arguments and Wagner let you know everything both sides argued. Also, maybe alive with Biggie, Jamie. We'll see if Anjanette can hop on. And we're just going to chew the fat about what we think while we wait for a verdict. It's going to be a nail biter, I think. All right, guys, have a good rest of your weekend. We'll see you soon.